My name is David Masonbring, and this is the third in a series called Investing in a Better World. Today's session is entitled, intentionally provocatively, What's Wrong with Charity? And I'll start by asking you, what makes your charitable donation ethical? I mean, presumably you donate charitably out of some ethical purpose. What makes it ethical?
Helping others.
Because we're not getting anything back.
The promise that it will be used ethically.
Well, that's your faith. You put your faith in that. What makes it ethical?
Your knowledge that at least most of the funds with a reasonable management fee are going to be used to benefit people for A, whom it's designated, and B, really need the funds, and three, it will
I'm going to stop you there.
Strengthen the hand of the poor and needy.
That's your faith. What makes it ethical? That's your faith.
Okay.
You said your knowledge. I'm going to challenge you in a minute to how do you know?
You're going to say that about this. I was going to say, everybody does better when everybody does better. That is, if there's more justice benefits everyone.
That's your motive. Good. Good. Yeah. We're talking about what makes for ethics, for good ethics.
Would it be lack of control?
You know, that we could just quit right there. That's where we're getting to. I'm going to ask the question again at the end. And, see whether the way you answer that question, what makes it ethical, has shifted at all. If it shifts, particularly in that direction, then I think I'll be gratified. I can take the rest of the day off.
I'm wondering if I could ask a question here. Why did you ask us what makes it ethical versus what makes it efficacious? When you give to charity, usually you would have a purpose in mind. Ethics assumes that the goal is maybe to do no wrong as opposed to accomplish a goal.
Yeah, I'm just trying to get your brains working in the direction of what is ethical. What makes it ethical? I don't have an answer. I'm just it's a warm-up test. This book, which is in the bookstore, which I highly recommend, which will not, I mean, you'll, by the end of the next hour, you'll figure out where I come down. I taught the book once at St. Mark's, and people got really angry with me because they couldn't figure out where he comes down on the question of help. It's all over the map, but it's very provocative. The Original Human Dilemma by Garrett Keyser. The book is called Help, and I'm going to quote it several times, starting with, "Help cuts about as close to the bone of what it means to be human as any subject I can think of," he writes. We are creatures who require a lot of help. Our ability to give and receive help may be our best alternative for defining humankind. I had never thought that way before. Our ability to give and receive help may be the best alternative for defining humankind, what it means to be human. All right, now this is important for Americans because we are a generous people. In 7 out of 10 U.S. households gave to charity in 2007. The largest single charitable recipient of American charitable dollars, of course, is religious charities, including your church. $306 billion. 3/4 of it from individuals. I don't have more current data, but it's been impacted by the recession, but it's characteristic of our culture. It's 2.2, that year it was 2.2% of gross national income. That's double the rate of other rich countries. But before we get too quick to pat ourselves on the back, we lag behind some of the other rich nations, particularly the Netherlands, in our volunteer work. 30%, an average 30% of Americans volunteer in a given year and average about 50 hours a year. That includes to your churches. Where we, and that lags behind other countries. Another place we lag behind, of course, is in tax rates. We want to give individually rather than support some corporate decision making on behalf of the whole country about how to help. According to the Wall Street Journal, which on November 9th of 2009 had this whole supplement, Charitable Giving, How to Fix It. Now, the Wall Street Journal is, you know, pro-business, Republican. Listen to what they said about, well, what the lead story's author says. Several academics have estimated that not more than, so here's the if we give individually rather than through our taxes to some corporate structure, what happens? And here's the answer. Several academics have estimated that not more than 3 to 5% of all foundation money, not your private dollars now, but the wealthiest people put their money into foundations, and foundations are the biggest giver. 3 to 5% of all foundation money goes to organizations serving the poor, people of color, women and children at risk, gays, lesbians, disabled, and troubled youth. Almost 50% of the American population. Though universities and colleges, hospitals, museums, and arts groups raise that percentage of philanthropic dollars spent for this purpose to no more than 12 to 15%. Individual wealthy donors are apparently even stingier in their giving to poor and disadvantaged populations. A study issued in late 2007 of 8,000 large donations made from 01 to 03 show that universities and colleges, medical organizations, and arts and cultural institutions received the overwhelming amount of that money. Why? It's a simple answer. Why do those groups get so much money?
What is taking care of each other?
The benefit of the people who are giving, in many cases, the benefit of the people who are giving the money.
Naming opportunities. Naming opportunities in publicly transited organizations. And your own affiliation. You know, your university has fundraising staff that track how you're doing with the education they give you. And they know exactly how to help you be thankful for that. Many people face life crises, life-threatening crises in hospitals. And hospitals do very well. Universities are the number one. Churches, religious organizations are number one. But once you take them out of the picture, universities and hospitals get the largest share of our charitable dollars. Janet Papendieck, whose book was in the bookstore, but I couldn't find it this morning to lift it up, Sweet Charity, how many know it? Anybody read? She did a study of the food aid industry in the United States, and published this book, Sweet Charity, which I recommend. On researching food aid in the U.S., Janet Papendieck observes that the surge of charity comes at the price of justice. I'm starting to get unpopular here. I should have been, at the beginning I was going to say, it's been nice to get so much positive feedback from the teaching this week, but I know it's going to end this hour right now. Because in talking about charity, I'm really undermining a sacred cow, and I know it, but we need to look at it. The surge of charity comes at the price of justice. And then she this is a quote from her. The resurgence of charity is at once a symptom and a cause of our society's failure to face up to deal with the erosion of equality. Mm-hmm. We're trying to redress problems without asking why are they there. More significantly, she goes on to say, and more controversially, the proliferation of charity contributes to our society's failure to grapple in meaningful ways with poverty. Is that really true? Bring to mind your favorite charity. Just leave your congregation out of it for the moment. But bring to mind your favorite charity other than your congregation.
Oxfam.
Yeah, just bring it to mind, everybody. Thank you, but good. Why do you support it? Keep this in your mind. Ask yourself, why do you support it? What are two or three of the accomplishments that cause you to most favor that charity? And then ask yourself, how do you know? You know, is it faith? I define faith as believing what you can't know. Is it faith, or do you know? And if you know, if you think you know, is it based on an anecdote or some, you know, objective, measurable study of the whole phenomenon? Garrett Keyser says in Help, feeling good about what you're doing is no guarantee that you're doing any good. Charities don't tell you what they don't do. And I'll make a confession to that in that regard. Marie and I developed a charity in South Florida, Maritime Ministry. I've done whole sessions on it, though, so I better not start. But after 15 years of developing this charity, we shared one full-time job when we started, and when we left 15 years later, there were 35 employees. So it grew, and that took some fundraising. I learned, I had chief responsibility for the fundraising, and I never expected to increase charitable fundraising by pointing out to our supporters what Marie and I were haunted that we were not accomplishing. You know, it just didn't help loosen the charitable dollars to point out the difference between all that could be done for the people we were serving and what we were doing. We did better at fundraising when we gave potential donors a warm and fuzzy feeling for what we were doing. And we ultimately left that mission because we felt that we really got discouraged, personally discouraged, at what we were not accomplishing. So I felt better when I read on the Sunday before Thanksgiving an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. Okay, you know what Thanksgiving's like around this country, right? And the Sunday before Thanksgiving, in no less mainstream a publication than the Washington Post, Mark Wynn publishes this op-ed piece. When handouts keep coming, the food line never ends. Now, it's not unusual to find that kind of a theme, but it is unusual to hear it from someone who ran food banks in Connecticut for 25 years. Mm-hmm. Right? Only after he retired from that job, and he was very successful, and the food bank he ran grew over and over, just kept multiplying and expanding. Only when he retired would he write this kind of an op-ed. America's far-flung network of emergency food programs continues one of the largest charitable institutions in the nation. Its vast base of volunteers and donors and its ever-expanding distribution infrastructure have made it a powerful force in shaping popular perceptions of domestic hunger and other forms of need. But one of its most lasting effects has been to sidetrack efforts to eradicate hunger and the root cause, poverty. He quotes Janet Papendieck. As she made clear in Sweet Charity, there's something in the food banking culture and its relationship with donors that dampens the desire to empower the poor and take a more muscular public stand against hunger. He uses much of the op-ed to talk about going into a poor neighborhood and watching the food truck arrive in the lines and so forth and so on. And then says, talks about a donor-recipient codependency. Both parties, he writes, were trapped in an ever-expanding web of immediate gratification that offered the recipients no long-term hope of eventually achieving independence and self-reliance. As the food bank's director later told me, the more you provide, the more demand there is. And this codependency, he says, is multifaceted and frankly troubling. The multifaceted nature of it is, one, there's a codependency between the nation's food industry, which often regards food banks as a waste management tool that is tax deductible.
Right?
Secondly, he said there's a whole army of volunteers who are dependent on the carefully nurtured belief that they are doing good by feeding the hungry. We can all relate to that. And thirdly, the capital campaign needs of the food bank industry require that staff maintain a ready supply of well-heeled philanthropists and captains of industry, and I'll add, because I had to cultivate them too, we basically give them good PR. Mm-hmm. The seaport that had crew members that Marie and I were serving during the 15 years we were there became one of the leading cruise ports in the nation. And we're serving their workers, and there was this delicate dance that I had to do between getting them to support us by giving them opportunities to look like they really cared about their workers without asking the question, why are their workers in need of charitable help? Food banks are a dominant institution in this country, and they assert their power at local and state levels by commanding the attention of people of goodwill who want to address hunger. Their ability to attract volunteers and to raise money approaches that of major hospitals and universities. While none of this is inherently wrong, he writes, it does distract the public and policymakers from the task of harnessing the political will to end hunger in the United States. And I just am a big enough believer in Bread for the World to want to say right now that, you know, there's nothing wrong. I support food banks and hunger programs, and we need to feed the hungry who are on the streets. But hear from this guy who ran them very successfully for 25 years. Let it not be a distraction from the advocacy work done by Bread for the World, which is not as feel good, frankly, as it is to stand in line at your local food bank and hand out food. But both are really important, and if you have to bet on one or the other to really make a difference down the road, I'd go with advocacy. It raises disturbing questions about who gets helped how by our charitable work. And Keyser says, the clarity that comes with an opportunity to help can amount to a dangerous distraction, sometimes from the very responsibilities that want our help most. Evidence this choice between feeling good about handing out food today or doing the hard work of changing large-scale public policy. The liberation theologian from Central America, Juan Segundo, writes, the world that is so satisfying to us is the same world that is so utterly devastating to the poor. And we need to ask ourselves whether we're feeling better about living in this world by doing our charity, or are we changing the world for the poor in ways that they value? Gerrit Keyser again. Keyser, to help another person towards greater self-determination is sooner or later to give that person power over your self-determination. That's deep. But it's true, I think. I mentioned yesterday this book by Peter Singer, The Life You Can Save. And I want to reference it again today. He does four surveys on the percentage of U.S. government spending on foreign aid. He cites four surveys. It's four surveys that are done to kind of gauge how Americans feel about the percentage of what they think the percentage of U.S. government spending on foreign aid is. And the results were consistent in all four surveys. Generally, Americans think that the United States government probably spends between 15 and 20% of its foreign aid, of its government spending on foreign aid. Not a group like this, but these are surveys that are done of the average American citizen. And then the surveys say, well, what do you think should be spent on government? What percentage of government aid should be spent on foreign aid? And they say, well, 5 to 10%. So we think it's 15 to 20%, but it should be 5 to 10%, and that's why we want to cut it. It's actually under 1%. And I cite this as an example of the illusion of our generosity, and can we ask perhaps also its effectiveness? Or who's being helped how? Does charity do more than help the helper? Does it do more to help the helper than those it claims to help? I'm going to reveal the quote I used on the board there just to get you in here. It comes from this novel by Chinua Achebe, my favorite African novelist and Nigerian. Hasn't written much, but it has made his first book, Things Fall Apart, has 2 million copies in print. It's probably the best read piece of African literature that's ever been written. And, you know, it's a downer, but it's important to read. How many have read it? Yeah, quite a few of you. Good. It's in the bookstore. This is their copy, and there are other copies there. And it tells the story of mission Christianity's, Western mission Christianity's encounter with traditional African society, and some of the results that those raising money for global missions don't want to talk about. In his latest novel, published around 1990, Anthills of the Savannah, he tells this story that I'm going to read. It's a couple paragraphs long, but it's worth it. A couple of months ago, the protagonist of the story, Ikim, had been persuaded against his normal inclination to speak at the local Rotary Club's weekly luncheon. On that particular occasion, the club had more cause than usual to be happy with itself, for it had just bought and donated a water tanker to a dispensary, a clinic, in one of the poorest districts of town, an area that has never had electricity nor pipe-borne water. I just love this next sentence. In the after-dinner haze of good works, cigar smoke, and liqueur, his host sat back to hear what their distinguished guest had to tell them. Well, as usual, Ikim left what he should have told them and launched into something quite unexpected. Charity, he thundered, is the opium of the privileged. From the good citizen who habitually drops 10 cents from his loose change and from a safe height above the bowl of the leper outside the supermarket, to the group of good citizens like yourselves who donate water so that some Lazarus in the slums can have a syringe boiled clean as a whistle for his jab and his sores dressed more hygienically than the rest of him. To the band-aid stars that lit up so dramatically the dark Christmas skies of Ethiopia. While we do our good works, let us not forget that the real solution lies in a world in which charity will have become unnecessary. The rotund geniality of his hosts was instantly shattered and distorted into sharp-pointed shapes of aggressiveness. That world of yours will be in heaven, sneered one gentleman. Even in heaven, said another, there's seniority. Archangels are senior to common angels. As early as possible, Ikim was escorted out of the room by 2 club officials. Charity is the opium of the privileged. There appears to be some science behind, scientific basis for this. There was a study, The Economist reported in 2006, that in a study at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders in stroke, subjects were given some money and told they could donate it anonymously to any range of charities. Using magnetic resonance imaging to map the activity of the various parts of the subject's brain, The researchers were able to examine what went on inside each person's head as they made decisions based on moral beliefs. Listen to what they found. They found that the part of the brain that was active when a person donated happened to be the brain's forward center, the mesolimbic pathway, responsible for doling out the dopamine-mediated euphoria associated with sex, money, food, and drugs. Thus, the warm glow that accompanies charitable giving has a physiological basis. Donating also engaged the part of the brain that plays a role in the bonding behavior between mother and child and in romantic love. This involves oxytocin, a hormone that increases trust and cooperation. This is powerful stuff. Peter Singer writes, I said yesterday, research on what makes people give more. And trust me, your favorite the fundraisers at your favorite charities read this stuff. And they know the best ones, in the nonprofit world, the best paid jobs are the fundraisers. They make sometimes more than the executive director.
Yes.
And they read the research that Singer has in here. I'm just going to cite a couple of the categories that he talks about. What makes people give more? The identifiable victim leads to the rule of rescue. We will spend more to rescue an identifiable victim than to save a statistical life, he says. And he cites the case of Jessica McClure in 1987, the 18-month-year-old who went into the dry well in Texas. And during the 2.5 days it took to save her, CNN was broadcasting the images from the drama of the scene. And millions poured in. It's reported that she has a multi-million dollar trust fund to rescue her. At the same time, UNICEF was complaining that 67,500 children died of preventable diseases around the world during those 2.5 days. We'll spend more, you know, particularly if it's televised, than to save one identifiable victim than we will a whole category of people who need help. He cites, and I don't mean to pick on Habitat here, the identifiable person moves us in a way that more abstract information does not. But the phenomenon doesn't even require particular details about the person. People asked by researchers to make a donation to Habitat for Humanity in order to house a needy family were told either, so two groups, right? One group is told that the family has been selected, or that the family, and the other group is told that the family will be selected. In every other detail, the wording of the request was the same. In neither case were the subjects told who the family was or would be, nor were they given any other information about the family. Yet the group told that the family had already been selected gave substantially more. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying there's a lot of science can be brought to what moves us to give. And charitable fundraisers are reading that science. And if we want to be ethical, maybe we should too. If we want to be effective in our ethics. Parochialism is another aspect governing how we give. The tsunami that struck Southeast Asia just after Christmas 2004 killed 220,000 people and rendered millions homeless and destitute. Americans gave $1.5 billion for disaster relief, the largest amount that we've ever given after any natural disaster outside the U.S. But it was less than a fourth of what we donated the following year, $6.5 billion, to help those affected by Hurricane Katrina, which killed about 1,600 people and left far fewer homeless than the tsunami. His point is, we will give more closer to home than we will those we identify with less. And, you know, Is that right? Well, I would just say if we are followers of God, we might want to ask whether God cares about the nationality as much as we do. The earthquake was the only one of the... Oh, and then he goes on to say, an earthquake in Pakistan in October 2005 that killed 73,000 people elicited a comparatively small 150 million in donations. That earthquake was the only one of these three tragic events that was not caught on video, and so it did not result in dramatic and often repeated television coverage. And a third reason why we don't give more, he says, is futility. People are, and he cites some studies that show that people are more willing to aid 1,500 victims out of a group of 3,000. You know, if you're given the choice, they've done studies, you can help save 1,500 people in a village of 3,000, or you can help save 1,500 people in a village of 10,000. Inevitably, we'll give more for the higher proportion than we will. Same number of lives saved by the same amount of money, but we'll give more to the one if it's half of all the victims than we will to the one where we're only 15% of the victims because of a sense of futility. I'm not saying there's anything sinful about that. It's just the reality that governs our charitable efforts to help. The proportion of lives saved often carries more weight than the number of lives saved. In a Holden publication in the winter of 2004, I wrote, is the way we approach social problems part of the reason they persist? Do we just do enough to feel better about ourselves and then say, I've done my part, and leave the issue unsolved? Steve Biko, the other night, I spoke about how he argues that that white liberals in South Africa fostered enough multiracial contact, you know, inviting blacks over for tea to talk about how do we end apartheid, just did enough to feel better about their own moving around in a divided society that benefited them. Is it possible that that same challenge or issue or dynamic is affecting us? Do we just assuage our guilt? Do we lack the kind of urgency that poor people have that drives them to find genuine solutions? Are we unconsciously pretty comfortable with the system as it is? And how does that work to drag our heels in really applying for, looking for solutions? How does the white superiority complex get there in the first place? And dare we ask whether churches have anything to do with it? I already referenced Things Fall Apart, about the encounter between mission Christianity and traditional African society. How many have seen Barbara Kingsolver's read The Poisonwood Bible? All right, quite a few of you, so I don't need to tell you about it. You tell the rest of the group here for a minute. What dynamic was active there that is reflective of a white superiority complex? Anybody? Say more, but yeah, you're right. It's a Baptist, Southern Baptist missionary, white missionary, takes his whole family and moves to what is today called Congo to save souls. And what happens?
He has a nervous breakdown.
Eventually. But he never wavers from his objective, which is to save others. Eventually, it drives him crazy. How about his kids?
begin to think of it as home, but in the sense that it's in its raw reality.
Except for the one sister.
Yeah, the one sister.
Yeah. Who flees.
Who?
Who flees.
Who flees.
She marries the South African guy, and she remains very colonial in her attitudes.
She keeps her sanity by joining a white supremacist society. The others, though, you're right, Susan. A couple of the other children.
And the mother. And
that's right. That's right. I mean, it's a novel, but it's Judy. It's a great metaphor for this whole idea that I have the truth and let me give it to you exactly as I got it. I was just astonished entering the Mission Enterprise myself at a time that folk masses were getting popular in the United States. And I remember talking to black seminarians in South Africa about music and what kind of music God would accept. And they were absolutely, these were Anglicans, so I'm sure Lutherans would have been more progressive, right? They were absolutely convinced that God would not find acceptable worship that included drums. Now, where does that come from?
England.
Comes from missionaries who said, God likes an organ best. If you don't have one, a piano will do. And if you don't have either of those, then just sing for all you're worth, but never, ever bring drums in. Because drums were foreign to the missionaries and culturally foreign. And they, you know, it was kind of scary how people got excited from the drumming. Or the drumming was going off on the other end of the village and they felt it like competition. The garden is a metaphor. When we put all our trust in our truth, and just give it exactly the way God gave it to us. I mean, that's the missionary enterprise that I was raised on. I have the gospel, and it's such a wonderful gift. I'm called to share it exactly as I got it. I used a reference about language in the Vespers on Monday night. Mm-hmm.
In English or Norwegian?
It was German.
German.
But you could draw the... I intentionally didn't say that on Monday night, because the truth is, There's any number of examples, and you don't have to study the Mission Enterprise long to know that we are better at sharing our gifts than we are at receiving the gifts of the other. Mm-hmm. And I am now, you know, too late to do much good with it, convinced that God gives us evangelical call for the purpose of bringing us into an encounter, a mutually transforming encounter. I now say that unless there isn't mutual transformation going on in an exchange, there's not real, genuine ministry.
Amen.
I don't think there's ministry when it's only one way. I highly recommend the book. It's first of all, she's just one of my favorite authors and an investor in Oiko Credit, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But it's one of the few long books I've read that I really didn't want it to end by the time I got there. Any other reflections to share on this notion that there are some theological and missiological streams that intertwine with our practice of help that maybe serve the helpers more than the helped, although it didn't in the protagonist in the story. He goes crazy, but only because he couldn't grow through the encounter. His children, who end up the healthiest, grow from the encounter with Africa and actually join Africa. But other thoughts in the room about how our theology contributes to charity as the opium of the privileged.
Well, there's a tremendous condemnation of America in Ezekiel 16:14. What was the sin of your sister Sodom? Pride, fullness of bread, love of luxury, and you did not strengthen the hand of the poor and needy.
Or Isaiah 58. Is this the fast that I require of you? You know, piety. Loose the bounds of justice, of injustice. All right, what to do? I promised in the marketing pitch some more positive trends that maybe offer hope. And I think it's important. So one of the things I'm going to invite you to do is to, as you approach your charitable donations, classify the charities on a spectrum. This is my own typology, my own spectrum of charities. On the one hand, you've got this, on one end of the spectrum, you've got the cynically self-serving. You know, every once in a while, there's an article that comes out in the newspaper about somebody that's been busted. They're typically work the telephone. And they call you up, and they after they stop phoning you, they sit there and laugh at how much money they've squeezed out of people, but they never, ever intend to actually do what they promised to do. They set up a 501c3, and they run all of your donations through that, and they'll tell you anything that they think you want to hear. But, I mean, they usually have some kind of a line, but they never intend to actually do any of that. Those charities qualify as 501c3s. They can. There are ways to qualify as a 501c3. Well, maybe not. There are, says the nonprofit lawyer in the back of the room. Yeah. I mean, it's...
You can do it by line. Absolutely.
You can do it by line. And you can get away with it, and you can bilk people out of all kinds of money. So, now, there aren't... I'm not saying that's the mainstream of charities, okay? That's one end of the spectrum. But be aware that there are people out there who will tell you whatever you want to hear to get your charitable dollar and send you a tax donation, maybe, letter for it as well. But they'll never use it for the mission that they said they want. Moving toward the better end of the spectrum, there's the mission. There are the groups that have an authentic mission. They're mission-oriented, but they have very high overhead. All right, that's not as bad as the openly fraudulent, not openly, the deceptively fraudulent. But, you know, a big proportion of your dollar ends up going to the overhead rather than to fulfilling the objectives of the mission. In the middle maybe is the efficient Band-Aid. There's a fabulous, I love it. How many are from Seattle? And so community lunch. Is a highly efficient Band-Aid. It's a fabulous program. Operates out of Central Lutheran Church. They lend their fellowship hall. It's 3 days a week, I think. It has one employee, the type who works tirelessly all the time, you know, and can expect an early grave for his reward, probably, maybe. I don't know. I hope not. Leverages the input of tremendous amounts of volunteer and free food, and then serves lunch to a gathering of people that include a lot of hungry. 3 times a week, Craig Rennebaum, who's a saint in my view, works that room and has a whole army of volunteers, and they find, including a lot of the hungry who come to eat. And when new people show up with problems, they get this specialist pastor to meet with them. It's an extremely efficient program, but at the end of the day, it is a Band-Aid for some of the injustices of our society. We need to do it, but we shouldn't stop and rest there. Then there's those who have a vision of transforming the other. You know, a really good vision for what would transform people in need. I think of water projects. Mm-hmm. I did a session a couple of years ago. I don't remember the statistic, but it's shocking how many wells that have been drilled for people aren't working today. It's a shocking statistic. Does anybody know it? A couple of you nodding your heads. It's something like, I mean, I shouldn't guess, I'm on tape here. There's a vision to help other people by helping them get access to safe water. But typically, if that vision is for how to help somebody else, it falls short of its goal. Evidence the garden issue that Judy referenced, you know. It wasn't a bad idea to help people, you know, to want to show them how to grow vegetables that will feed them better. Maybe it was short-sighted about what pollinators were needed or what was wrong. I think, I read the book a long time ago. Doesn't it come out of a failure of the missionary family's willingness to like indigenous food? Yeah, they didn't like the local food people were eating, so they thought, we'll teach them how to grow better food. Well, better in whose opinion? Our vision of how to help others is, I think, you know, moving along this spectrum in the right direction. But it's different from empowering the other for transformation. It's one thing for me to figure out, you know, to want to give you a well. And it's another thing for you. The reason those wells stop functioning, more often than not, is that people don't maintain them. And when they break, the village says, well, you know, that well belonged to X. You fill in the blank of a favorite organization. They built it. They should come and fix it. The best, I love Water First, water1st.org, for the way in which they work as community organizers in a community and refuse to do much more than animate the community to come together and figure out what its needs are. And when they get around to water and sanitation, then they will kind of behind the scenes help that community own the project. They will not bring in more resource than the community is contributing to it. And they make sure that along the way there's a whole body of local people that have become convinced that this thing is important to us and we own it and we did it and we'll maintain it and we'll get it fixed when it gets broken. So that's just a, yeah, Freddie. Yeah, well, it's identifying, yeah, but do we live in a place that doesn't have clean water?
No, that's just an extreme example. It could, I guess what I'm saying is when we live in a world where there's people who don't have clean water, and we do, as much as we work to empower societies and systems to be able to acquire their own clean water, is it ever truly stepping away from charity if it's not an act of solidarity, if it's not us experiencing what life is like without clean water, so that we truly are working for it because it becomes a necessity of our own, as well as a desire to simply give?
Great question.
I guess I think of it as, in harking back to what you said about what we can get from Africa, maybe what we're giving is the tools to get water, and what we're getting is the tools to make community. So it's not me, it's an exchange. It's true solidarity, but it's not the same. We're not, because we do have clean water, and we know how to get clean water, but we don't know the first thing about how to have community.
Or as much, or, and not what God gave to Africans that God didn't give to our culture.
Right, we don't know what that is.
In that Holden Village article, I ended up by saying that I thought what was needed was an attractive image of the victims. When we see them as people gifted by God in ways that God wants them to teach us, then we will be so concerned about them being held back by poverty that we will work to improve the terms of their life so that they survive, so that we can... Now, there's a certain cynicism in that, which is that, you know, we only are motivated by our self-interest. But I don't think we're only motivated by our self-interest, but I think we're motivated by more self-interest than we are willing to admit sometimes.
I wanted to ask maybe a lazy donor's question, which is, I like the framework. I'm convinced from your talk that as individual charitable donors, you can be susceptible to any number of flawed pitches, let's say. But how do you figure out then which ones to give to? Are there organizations that evaluate charities that go down your framework? I've heard of some that will get you to maybe two or three. In other words, tell you how much overhead does that charitable organization claim off the top from your donation. But in terms of how much true effect that organization has, is there such a thing as a ratings agency that would help a donor make good choices?
There are. Good question. There are. And some of them are listed in the book, as well as their strengths and their limits. There's a whole section on that. Charity Navigator is one. GuideStar.org is another one. In my experience, each of them have their strengths and their limits. So they're good for some things, and they're not as good for others. A couple other people want to speak to it. One, two. Good point. I mean, this reflects a scale of my values. So is there a charity evaluator that rates people on this spectrum? Not that I know of. But there are charity evaluators that will try to evaluate what percentage goes to overhead or not, for example. Which isn't... Now, some activities require more overhead than others. So the charities that really require a lot of overhead... don't look good by that standard. But I think those are good tools. They're worth employing. You just have to be aware of their limits, too. Joe?
The other way is to go out and do some of the work.
Yes.
And then you know where the money is ending up. And you can learn what lies behind all the charity rating tools, because different groups have different kinds of bookkeeping and different kinds of scoring. And you learn that sometimes that reporting is a big burden to an organization. It actually increases its overhead. And if you've worked with people, you know whether they're doing what you want them to be doing with your money. And even if you end up not supporting a group you work with, you at least know how the work gets done.
Now, to be constructive on what... Yes, sir?
I just wondered, what would happen if in our budget cutting we eliminated the tax deduction for charitable giving so that we don't rely on the government to decide what a viable charity is, so if we feel more comfortable in passing the $20 bill to the homeless guy with a cardboard sign? I mean, it would totally disrupt this whole system. But
yeah.
It bothers me that I only give to tax deductible charity.
Yeah, well, I'm tempted to start down that path. Tammy, who was in the village, I think she just left, from Bread for the World. Bread for the World organized around Minneapolis. She was at a forum last week talking about, what did she equate? She had it's the same amount of money. One of the things that's on the table to be cut is eliminating the mortgage deduction for a vacation home. Right? Not the mortgage that I use on the house not the deduction I take for the mortgage on my house, but if I had a second vacation home, do you know that that amount of money that the government loses by offering people the chance to deduct the mortgage on their vacation home is equivalent to what statistic? Who remembers better than I do? I think it was it food aid programs for children? Something like, nobody remembers the stat. I don't either. But it's astonishing. It's at 8 point something billion dollars. And it's the same. Now, everybody wants to cut you know, I mean, the people who want to cut that want to keep the mortgage deduction on their vacation. That's another. We could have a whole session. We should. The village should talk about that. What to do? I highly recommend pick up this book and read it. And it's called Money and Faith by Mike Scott. The subtitle is The Search for Enough. And it has a study guide for individuals and also for groups. And I said yesterday, in my experience, if a group from your church studies this together, do not be surprised if 6 months later they want to split up and form three groups. They each want to kind of fan out and form groups of their own to get others to study. It's very powerful and raises provocative questions. It's not by one author. It's an anthology, so a lot of different readings by different people across the spectrum. And I highly recommend Money and Faith.
Is Bread for the World tax deductible?
Bread for the World has an educational foundation that is tax deductible, but it's advocacy work, you know, trying to change government policy is not deductible.
That was kind of my point, that often the way you can have the best impact is through organizations that are not tax deductible.
Right.
You're not giving directly to the people, but you're trying to change.
And in my own approach to that and how much I'm willing to give and the influence of whether I can claim it as a tax deduction or not, what does that say about my motivation to help others versus myself? Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about me, mm-hmm. Susan.
Organizations that teach the people how to be advocates are tax deductible. I get it. So we're the organizer. We don't have paid advocates. We teach people how to do advocacy. That is tax deductible.
Good. Good. All right, I think, you know, what you can do. One is buy this book and read it and wrestle with the themes long after you've gone down lake. Secondly, really demand measured outcomes. I spoke about Esther Duflo at the Poverty Lab at MIT, who got this whole New Yorker profile last year on her revolutionizing international aid by bringing hard science, controlled experimentation to what is actually, what are the measurable outcomes of what you're doing? Duflo, D-U-F-L-O, the Poverty Lab was the title of the article. And I think it was in May of 2010 in the New Yorker. Invest versus donate. Why?
Tracking method of the success of your donation, as it were. If you're, for example, giving money to establish a small business or help someone to establish a small, just one person business, and they're successful, you have tracked, you're able to track the success of that, and you can do it, in a sense, again and again. So those people frequently reinvest or whatever the achievement is that they're trying to achieve. It could be growing food, it could be textiles, it could be a great number of things that presumably improve people's lives.
Right, yeah. A program-related investment as opposed to a charitable donation keeps, you know, is the gift that keeps on giving as long as they get. Also, I would argue for investment rather than donation because we track our investments, right? Nonprofit fundraisers have learned not to tell us, not to confuse us with the facts about our donation, because we'd rather believe that that donation of mine has done all kinds of things that it hasn't done, because I'll feel better about that. But your investments, you track them. Now, would you track your social investments? If you were investing for a social purpose, would you track it as well as you track your investments for...
I think people do, and I think there are many more organizations coming to the idea that there are people who are willing to invest in a trackable. Maybe they do not get their money back, but the organizations are asking for follow-up.
Right.
They are distributing information on that. Now, you can't necessarily know how accurate it is, but nevertheless, there's attempts are being made to track it.
And that'll be the focus on Friday. I'll be talking about an organization which does exactly that and why I think it's a great. I just have to say that I think more often than not, ecumenical efforts can be closer to this than denominational efforts, which are more likely to be here because the denomination has boundaries and it has to be accountable to itself for how it meets the goals.
Yes.
Lastly, and then I also want to say tomorrow's session on travel will be a lot about this. We have to learn to listen and to learn in order to get over the white superiority complex's innate sense that we know how to help. I'll talk tomorrow about a group I took to Nicaragua last December where we tied the service-oriented hands behind our backs and said, we're not going to do any service projects. God, I'm getting ahead of myself. So, what makes your charitable donation ethical? Would you use the same answer now as you did an hour ago? And if it's gotten a little more complex, good, we're on the way. So keep going.